Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In 1989, a new star entered the American living room and stayed. He was ugly, square-headed, squeaky-voiced, and hugely popular. His name is Bart Simpson. For the 14 million Simpsons viewers, the show's dialogue captures perfectly the self-directed frustration of the American middle class and an existential angst that has pervaded pop culture since, well, audiences stopped taking the Brady Bunch seriously. After September 11th, a flurry of critics pronounced the death of irony. And then, of course, it didn't happen. So much for the crystal ball. But some observers now say that irony and its compatriot, selfishness, is indeed on the way out, and an earnest celebration of teamwork and heroism is on its way in.
In my 3 years at Harvard, I have come to find that passion is a key ingredient to the study and practice of law and of life. It is with passion, courage of conviction, and strong sense of self that we take our next steps into the world. Remembering that first impressions are not always correct. You must always have faith in people. And most importantly, you must always have faith in yourself. Congratulations, class of 2004. We did it!
And that, of course, was actress Reese Witherspoon in Legally Blonde. So, Connection listeners, is American popular culture entering a new age of sincerity? Are the music, movies, and TV shows you're watching getting lighter, brighter, and more sentimental? And if pop culture is indeed becoming sunnier and less barbed, what's driving it? Is it real generational change or just Hollywood's appetite for something new? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And one person who has been studying popular culture for the past 20 years is Robert Thompson. He's been observing it from Syracuse University, where he is director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Glad you could join us. Also joining us is William Strauss, who is a satirist and co-founder of The Capital Steps. He's in a good place to reflect on the state of American humor. He's also the author of several books about generational change, including his latest, Millennials Rising, The Next Great Generation. And Bill, I can't introduce you without taking note of the fact that you have four of your own millennial generation folks, what, ages 17 to 24, I believe?
I have some children of my own who are probably the most interviewed kids in the history of generational scholarship.
And I'm sure they're very kind to you. Bill, let me start with you, because I would imagine it's fair to say that you're not surprised this new generation doesn't seem to have a lot of interest in irony. Is that because they are rebelling against what went before, or do they just find it boring and irrelevant?
All of that. Generational rebellion doesn't always go to more edginess. It has with Generation X, and it certainly did with boomers, but before that it did not. And each generation, as it comes along, will set itself off stylistically from the one that came before and will try to correct what it perceives are the excesses of its dominant parent group in middle age. But what really happens from time to time, about every 20 years or so, is there is a jolt that the society feels that causes all generations to take stock of where they are in their life. And this has a way of filtering down into the pop culture, not right away, but gradually. We certainly recall that after the John Kennedy assassination in 63. And around 64, 65, the culture began to change. And by the time we got to 1970, it was unrecognizable. And it was hugely defined by the young generation then coming of age, of course, the boomers. And 9/11 could be the same kind of event that's pushing us in a direction. But it's a very different direction from back then. And by the time we get to the year 2010, I think we'll look back on this decade as having been defined, particularly in the culture, by the millennial generation.
Hmm. And Bob, I wonder if that's what you're seeing as well in the classroom, college students who might look at David Letterman and see not an edgy comic, but an old phony who's or fogey, rather, not phony.
Well,
sorry.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, David Letterman, for me, when he started, I was in college, he was about the hippest thing out there. And I think he really became kind of the crown prince of that 20-year reign of the new irony. To my college students, he's the old guy. He's what Johnny Carson was for us back then. And I agree with this notion of these kind of cultural flashpoints. And it's interesting how when the real kind of first wave of modern irony started, it was back after World War I. If you read all those F. Scott Fitzgerald novels, they sound surprisingly similar to our contemporary stuff. There's some lines in those novels that could have come out of Chandler Bing's mouth. Without too much alteration. It's interesting how there the big cataclysm, World War I, which was this kind of level of horror no one had known before, resulted in the birth of a new irony. Now the speculation is that September 11th is going to result in the contraction of that irony. I think it will contract. Sincerity is going to be allowed a place that it wasn't allowed over the last 20 years. But I think also irony is never going to go away. People born in 1980 simply have the ironic lifestyle as something they take for granted, like gravity or the first law of thermodynamics. They don't even think about it, and therefore they've got some room for some other things to come in, especially those that indicate a degree of rebelliousness from the previous generation.
One generation's punchline is the next generation's setup line.
Right, this, exactly.
So what Generation X might think is highly ironic is just wallpaper today's teenagers.
Interesting.
Bob,
yeah, go ahead.
I like your point about World War I because what we saw in the 1920s was a culture very, very much like the 1990s. Then it was referred to as a decade of bad manners and morals. And what's a curious parallel is how the stock crash of 1929 put an end to that, not immediately, but around 1930-31. And the historians of that era note how the celebrities just washed away. The flagpole sitters came down because nobody was watching them.
And the novels,
elegance came back. Yeah, and F. Scott
Steinbeck,
Fitzgerald.
The post office, yeah. Right.
But then that all changed dramatically in the 30s, right, Bill?
Well, in the 30s, you had that shift away from the lost generation attitudes, from the detached, ironic, hip style. The flaming youth became the team youth. You had an emergence of Busby Berkeley-style bigness, of Fred Astaire elegance, of stories in cinema that reflected good people faced with very difficult circumstances, sometimes very tragic circumstances. You have the Frank Capra movies.
Speaking of that, Bill, we just happen to have a clip from Babes in Arms, which I'm sure you remember is the Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland film that was made in 1939. This particular clip, we have Mickey and his friends who are the children of vaudeville performers, and they're all getting together to help their parents save their way of life.
Listen, are you kids willing to stick together and pull yourselves out of a hole?
You bet. Sure.
I've got an idea. Our folks think we're babes in arms, huh? Well, we'll show them whether we're babes in arms or not. I'm going to write a show for us and put it on right here in Seaport. Why, it'll be the most up-to-date thing these hicks around here have ever seen. Opening night, we'll have Max Gordon, Sam Harris, Lee Schubert down to give us the once-over. How about it, kid? We'll get every kid in this town on our side, and we'll start right now. What do you say? Right now. Come on, kids, let's go!
They call us babes in arms.
So, Bill, I guess that doesn't sound like that big a leap from Babes in Arms to Legally Blonde.
Well, we're going through the same kind of transition. Today's millennials, teenagers particularly, but we're starting to see it in college, too. The kids born in the 1980s are showing the same kind of upbeat attitude, team playing, interest. They love to do shows big. They love choreography. They love sets and costumes. The same kinds of things that boomers were stripping out in the 1960s, they're putting back.
And, Bob, how is this playing out on television? Are you seeing the same trend there, or is that being produced by the Gen Xers who don't get it?
Well, I think the Gen Xers are beginning to get it, and they realize how they've got to go with this cultural flow. The WB is the youngest skewing of all the six networks. And if you look at some of the programs on the WB, they are so sincere as to make a baby boomer almost want to cringe. Everwood and Gilmore Girls.
But it's the kind of thing we feel that we ought to be seeing, right, with our kids?
We want our kids to watch those, even though we never would have watch those ourselves. It's kind of like Bill Clinton saying that they should all be in school uniforms.
No, and that is the interesting thing, is what exactly right. This stuff makes us uncomfortable. We feel like we should be laughing at it, but we don't want to because we want our kids to be watching it. And that's where this whole thing, I think, gets interesting and complicated. For one thing, once you've gone as far, ironically, as we went between 1982 and about now, you can never go back. I don't think any generation is going to recover its ironic virginity again. It's simply going to be altered. That Reese Witherspoon thing that you played, it's both incredibly sincere, but in the end, when she gives that little squeaky sort of thing, the punchline of that whole thing is that, yes, we just went through this lovely, sincere recovery of an older time, but that squeak at the end let you know, and we really know better than to take that as sincerely as it sounds, yet we kind of like to go back to that that whole thing. It's like we're in a post-ironic era of sincerity, and of course on TV, alongside of people watching Everwood, they're also watching Conan O'Brien, who's so ironic as to sometimes be incomprehensible at times.
And
yes,
we also...
but Conan is not a young guy anymore in the eyes of teenagers. And
right, but they're, they're watching him at a yeah. fair amount. I'm not sure about teenagers. College
them.
Students are still.
When I was a teenager, we were watching the Beach Party movies. We were listening to Pat Boone. But it said nothing about us back in the early 1960s. And you remember the slogan in George Lucas's first movie, American Graffiti, where were you in 62 before it all changed? And right now what we see in the culture is something that's similar to the early 60s, and that it's being put forward by a bunch of people in their 30s who just don't understand how teenagers are different today, a lot of them.
And why are they so out of touch, Bill?
Well, realize if you're 33 years old, you don't have any teenagers as children or siblings. And so often what you see with these programs are cartoons, are satires of their own experience from 1987 instead of what's really going on in school today.
And, Bob, I wonder if it also makes a difference that this generation of young people, unlike the baby boomers who grew up doing duck and cover drills out in the hallways because we were terrified of nuclear holocaust, these kids didn't have those fears growing up.
Yeah, I think it makes a big difference. Let's take someone born in 1980. They come of age in about 1990, and they see the world begin to unfold in front of them in one of these decades between 1989 in September 11th of 2001, which was in many ways this wonderful kind of daydream. You'd put $10 into a mutual fund in January, and by February it would be $14, and by Christmas it would have doubled. The Berlin Wall goes down. That sense of impending planetary doom disappears not overnight, but virtually overnight. So there's a completely different feeling to the planet that they come of age of. And I don't think they're thinking in their minds that this is informing their opinions. But clearly, the idea that you're going to die in a nuclear holocaust being present is going to change your opinions. Then, of course, September 11th comes along and replaces it with a new cloud. I think we'd be wrong to say, though, that generationally there's going to be this entire shift. I don't think it's a pendulum that goes from irony to sincerity and back again. The recipe is much more complex, but I think we are right to say that there is a place for sincerity that's a lot larger than there was 20 years ago, a generation ago.
All right. We'll hold the thought right there and take a quick break. Connection listeners, are you seeing a new sincerity, a new earnestness in pop culture? If so, what do you think is driving it? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. And this hour, we're talking about a change in pop culture with Bob Thompson, who studies television at Syracuse University, and Bill Strauss, founder of The Capital Steps and also author of several books about generational change. You can join the conversation as well at 1-800-423-8255. But first, let's all listen to a clip from the 1993 film Dazed and Confused.
I'm just saying, if we're going to go out, we're going to drive around, we should just do something.
Yeah, you know, you're right, man. I'm just going to you know, get drunk, maybe get laid, or get in a fight.
No, I'm serious, man. We should be up for anything.
I know, we are. But what? I mean, God, don't you ever feel like everything we do and everything we've been taught is just to service the future?
Yeah, I know. It's like it's all preparation.
Right, but what are we preparing ourselves for?
Death.
Well, Bill Strauss, not to turn you into the movie maven here, but how
well,
did
very
that...
Generation X, very, well, very X.
Yeah, and who was the audience that this movie was speaking to? And how did that message resound?
Those were the children of the late 60s and 1970s, the babies born then. And actually, Gail, if you trace that group, you can find even from their birth, we had what we call the evil child movies, the movies of the late 60s and through the 70s. If you were born around the time of Woodstock, when you were a fetus, you were Rosemary's Baby. When you were a little kid, you were Damien's Omen. You were Paper Moon. By the time you got into high school, you were Breakfast Club or Dazed and Confused or River's Edge. By the time you entered the workforce, you were Reality Bites. And even right now in commercials, you see 30-year-olds depicted as kind of stupid. And today's teenagers look at that and they think it's insane. They look at programs like Real World with 25-year-olds whining about each other, and they say, that's not what we're going to do. And I remember right before the break, Bob was perceptively describing how boomers came along fearing nuclear annihilation and things like that. Today's kids are mainly concerned about grades in college. And
right.
The stress that they feel is what's producing their jokes. I just talked to a young filmmaker yesterday who told me about her latest project, which is about somebody cracking under grade pressure. It's a very different set of stories they have now.
All right. Well, let's listen to one of those stories. We have a caller on the line from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, it's Liza, actually.
Sorry, Liza.
It's all right. Thanks. I'm 20, and I go to Oberlin College. And I just wanted to say that at least among my friends, that irony is still very much alive. I don't know. The Simpsons are still a favorite show. And I think that instead of sort of fear of a cataclysmic event, that instead there's sort of more of a general hopelessness, just looking at the state of the environment and the way politics are going and the war in Iraq. So I think that there's still something that young people are responding to, which is producing this irony, at least in my generation. And one thing that's interesting is my sister is 16, and I see less of the irony, and I see more, like you were saying, just worries about grades and not sort of looking on a wider level. So,
well, it's an interesting point, Liza.
Yeah.
Thanks. And,
so thank you.
Hang with us if you'd like to for a moment, because I'd be curious what Bill says about that. Are you maybe drawing the line a little bit high? Is it the 16 and 17-year-olds who fit more into this mold?
Me and my friends would be sad to see irony go.
Well, every generational change is gradual, of course. And what you look at is the overall tone that's being set in these places. Who's having to deal with, who are providing the leadership of the new tone, who's following, who's resisting it. We found back in the late 1960s that while there were only maybe 8 or 10% who fit the full definition of what a hippie was, they set the tone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we're going to find is that it will be today's high school kids who will really bring this change to college, that those who are in colleges now are feeling it a little bit, but the main event is coming. The surveys are showing that today's teenagers are the happiest age bracket, whereas 10 years ago they were the most cynical age bracket.
I think Liza makes a good point, though, that she sees among her fellow students that irony is still alive and well. I agree that these changes come, and there's this almost organic inhaling and exhaling from generation to generation. On the other hand, I think irony is such a useful cultural tool. It is now so totally and completely embedded that I think it's going to be more how they use irony as these generations change, and not the elimination. I really don't. I guess as much as I like this idea of walking into a college classroom 10 years from now and have everybody completely saying what they mean and sharing their school supplies with each other and all the rest of it, is a lovely image. But I think human nature is so much more attuned to the kinds of things that irony delivered. And once we learn this language, for example, it's the greatest defense mechanism, the old way of sincerity when you wanted to ask someone to the prom and you said, will you go to the prom with me? Good, sincere question. And they said, no, you were left hanging. By the way, I know this from experience. Whereas in the ironic mode, well, that's a whole other, I don't want to talk about
okay.
But on the ironic mode, you go, oh, can you believe all these lame people on the prom committee with this decoration and what, wouldn't it be fun to just go and see how lame this gets?
Well, Bob, in a way,
says,
irony,
no, you're clear.
Irony has a denominator and a numerator in the sense that something like Bart Simpson said something fresh around the early 90s, whereas right now it's the base for parody for somebody
absolutely
who's a teenager.
Right.
They will still right. watch it, but it is their starting point. It is their premise. And of course they will find something unusual about it. They'll find some twist that doesn't apply to their common experience. There was a comment that Mark Russell once made to me, and he attributed it to Lenny Bruce, and he said that it's difficult for a comedian of one generation to make someone from the next generation laugh at a joke that has a cultural connection.
So is it generational change then that's driving this, Bill?
I think it is. They have a very different life experience. It's one thing to encounter Bart Simpson when you're already in college, let's mm-hmm. say in 1992. It's another thing to encounter it when you're in second grade.
Sure, it plays very differently according
right.
to where
and
you are.
I agree with that. I'm just saying I think we're looking at irony as though it's a category like rock and roll music versus big band or this kind of thing. I'm saying that irony is actually bigger than that. It's like music or it's like mm-hmm. comedy in that new generations are going to find different ways to sculpt that irony and our ironists will be considered square compared to theirs. But I think irony itself is much more deeply embedded in our culture, and the general cultural and generational changes are going to reshape irony, but not going to go away.
Yes, it's like humor. Every generation will have its sense of humor, but what the joke will be will change.
Well, let's bring in someone else who's had a front row seat on these changes. Donna Learmont has been a high school teacher for the past 18 years.
Oh, boy.
She teaches video production at Laser High School in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. Hi, Donna. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So how do you see this? What's driving, and do you see a change? And if so, what do you think is driving it?
I see a shift in high school students from when I started in the mid-80s. And I'm not sure what to attribute it to. I know we have a lot of cultural concerns about kids being overscheduled and in daycare and those sorts of things. And I think one of the manifestations of that has been that they're much more cooperative and instead of competitive, as Mr. Strauss was talking about them doing community theater and that kind of thing. They're a much more group oriented.
Especially socially, right? I see them traveling kind of in packs. It's not pairing up as much as
yeah,
the boomers
did,
I think.
Yeah, but not in the sense of cliques as much as in the past. I think there's a lot more tolerance for individuality. And as a video production teacher, what I see is that when we first started doing this, the legitimacy and the credibility came from modeling what was out there on broadcast television. And now they're so media savvy that it's just an extension of who they already are. If they're a skateboarder, then they're skate videos. If they're in student government, then maybe they're more activist videos, that kind of thing. It's they own the media. They have a computer in front of them, so their message can be print. It could be make your own newspaper, or it could be compose your own song or make your own video program or have your own website. So mm-hmm. their forms for expression are much greater than they mm-hmm. have been in the past. And
well, there are three ways that adults can see the real youth culture today, and I think you're putting your finger right on them. First is high school theater. Go see a big musical at a high school if you haven't in a while, and you'll be amazed at what the kids are doing. Secondly is what you're doing, which is video. They're doing a lot of interesting projects there. And the third is what they're doing on their own websites.
Absolutely.
And Donna, I'm also curious, when you see this group of young people doing, for example, volunteer work, is that because they feel an obligation to do that? Is it just because it looks good on their college application, or because they genuinely want to do something worthwhile?
Well, it's a combination of those things, and also because many high schools across the country now have this as a mandate. But when that was introduced, our high school was actually, I think, one of the first in the country to require this for graduation, and people scoffed at it. People at the graduation ceremony where it was mentioned laughed at the premise. And now it's just so much of their ordinary, everyday life that kids do it willingly, gladly, see the value of it, and it is great for their resume, great for their college application. But they can also see that they're deriving a benefit from it, and they feel that they're connected to their community.
And they support each other's activities a lot. Do you find that, Donna?
Yes.
And that's a big difference from what we saw about 10 years ago. We have this program here called the Cappies, and I think you've got it in Detroit as well, where high school students attend and review each other's shows and publish the reviews in major newspapers, and then they gather to produce regional shows. And the whole attitude is towards creating something as a team. And that is why the Andy Hardy movies, the Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland, let's put on a show attitude is coming back. And it feels very fresh because nobody has living memory of the 30s and the youth culture then.
Well, I think it's very interesting that you use the Mickey Rooney clip, because what they were doing was putting on a show to save their parents and the community, or whatever the case was. It's very interesting that now the kids are so in tune with technology that many teachers and parents rely on the kids to help them through the technological hoop.
Exactly.
So they have a function where many times, you know, in the past, the kids didn't have a fit in society, and now they're filling a void that the adults themselves often can't.
Mm. Yeah. And you know where that void comes from? It's from the passing of the last generation that we associated with upbeat attitudes, team playing, civic spirit, heroism, the generation that fought and won World War II. And now when the kids step into that role, it feels very fresh to them, and it's their form of rebellion.
Donna, we want to thank you so much for being with us, and good luck with your continuing video work with these students.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Let's go to our phone lines now and hear from one of our listeners from Peterborough, New Hampshire. Phyllis is on the line. Hi, Phyllis.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. And I wanted to ask Dr. Thompson primarily, how much of this change is driven by corporations and their interest in profit as opposed to coming up from the culture itself?
Well, I think a lot of it. I think it's interesting, and this relates to the last caller as well, where to a great extent, some of this stuff we have educated into our students' heads. We're much more cognizant of teaching people not to be bullies and not to be cliquey, which a generation ago it didn't happen. The other thing is that the corporations have, in fact, in very sophisticated ways, begun to target market these specific groups. After all, we need to educate this next generation of consumers. MTV, I guess, was a good example of this a half generation back. That starts in 1981, where you introduce this whole generation to a corporate entity, MTV, and in fact, the generation got named after it. The only television network ever to have a generation named after it, the MTV generation. And they were fully cognizant of the fact that they were being manipulated, that this was a corporate entity, and that they were part of its whole equation. But at the same time, unlike the generation before, they were not in the least bit outraged about it. It was almost as though the baby boomers were the generation that was manipulated by the media and corporate commercial culture. The Generation X really became cynical and ironic about that manipulation, and now the next generation comes by, is fully aware, fully cognizant, media literacy educated, yet they're still completely able to live within that kind of confine. If
well,
Generation
doing one
X
thing
had
more.
Guilty pleasures, these people aren't guilty for their pleasure.
That's true. What today's kids are doing is in some ways far more damaging to the corporations, and they're not doing it out of a political point-making, but rather is just a natural response. Look at what's happening with music. They're downloading songs The music industry is fighting them in much the same way Selective Service was fighting us back in the 1960s, trying to enlist colleges to track people down and sue them or arrest them or one thing or another. And meanwhile, the kids are just turning away from the music industry, unlike anything we've ever seen.
Right. The boomers are buying it, and the younger people are just downloading it.
Yes, that's right.
So the young, this emerging generation of teenagers are still very, very big consumers. It's not like they've, you know, come to, you know, cobbling their shoes and sewing their own clothes. They still
However, for the last several years, they've been buying fewer and fewer CDs. And
CDs,
that's been a problem
right.
for the
right.
music industry. Yeah. Of course, they're big consumers of the pop culture, but the music industry is hurting with teens.
Well, yeah, that's true. They found other places to put that disposable income.
And I do have to ask here as well, there is 9/11 looming over these young people. It had to be a defining event for them, and yet here they are being optimistic despite a bad economy, worries about terrorism. I mean, do they know something we don't, Bill?
The big question on campuses today is how these ambitious kids will handle a difficult economy when they graduate. Today's 22-year-olds are already encountering that, and they are so optimistic about their personal futures. They do expect more terrorism. There was just a Gallup survey that showed that 75% of them expect more terrorist attacks, but they are confident in the use of science and in their own ability to come up with measures to deal with it. And it's really the optimism about everyone's future and their own future personally that distinguishes this group from the last two generations as they came of age.
Are you seeing that as well, Bob?
Yeah, what I'm noticing, and I encounter 400 students per semester in my classes, and that optimism is definitely there, and they spend a lot more time talking about their futures with regards to their personal achievements and everything than they do about the overall civic state of the world. September 12th, 13th, and 14th, they thought about it a lot, but they were back on track pretty quickly. There is, though, a sense that within this optimism and this let's put on a show attitude is also kind of a frightening underpinning, and that in many cases the optimism exceeds what they actually want to do to get it. It's the what I call the air guitar phenomenon, which is that they have a very great sense of the style and the surface of the jobs they want, whether it's movie director or broadcast journalist or whatever. A lot of them, however, are way more optimistic than they are, in fact, ambitious. And that's a sense where I think some of this return to the new sincerity might have a more dangerous flip side.
We're exploring this hour a change in pop culture from bitter to sweet, ironic to earnest. What are you seeing? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. We're talking with author Bill Strauss and critic Bob Thompson this hour about a coming move towards sincerity and away from irony in movies and music and television. Connection listeners, what do you think? Are we moving toward a sweeter and more serious attitude in pop culture? Are today's kids, 21 and under, more optimistic and earnest than, let's say, Gen Xers or the baby boomers, or not? Call us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And gentlemen, one of the things we haven't really explored here yet is gender differences, because you will note that in Legally Blonde 2, it was not Mr. Smith going to Washington this time. It was Ms. Ellie, perky in pink, you know, color coordinated all the way down to her chihuahua's coat.
That's right.
And there she was.
Well, we're seeing a girl culture that is reigning supreme, at least so far, among millennials. And it's a culture that is pushing away from risk, that has a lot of the responsibility for the declining crime rate, the declining teen birth rate, the declining substance abuse, a lot of things that we're seeing that most adults would consider positive among millennials. Back in the 1960s, you had the opposite. You had the boy culture reigning supreme, pushing towards risk, higher crime, more sexual risk-taking, more substance abuse. Back then, 57% of college first-year students were men. Now 57% are women. And there are a number of professions, including law, that are starting to tip in a feminine direction. It'll be very interesting to see where millennials take this. Do you see this, Bob?
Yeah, it's although I don't think it's just happening on the sincerity thing on that was a female character. I look at a male character like on The Matrix, who that guy's so sincere by the end of it, you're begging for some irony to please relieve you from all that philosophy kind of thing. So I think it is crossing gender roles. There was a book written a couple of years ago by a guy named Jedediah Purdy that got a lot of attention, and it was about trying to retreat from irony. He was about 24 when he wrote it, and it was a beautiful and wonderfully sincere little book. I think it was called Uncommon Things. But once again, by the time you were at the end of that book, you were dying to turn on an episode of Conan or The Simpsons. And that's
well, there are a lot of 35-year-olds who don't like this at all, believe me.
Yeah, and I guess maybe that's part of it. I mean, it is strange to think that the group of people that grew up watching MTV and making fun of the Brady Bunch have now got kids in the house that are shaking their heads thinking, you know, that MTV is for the old farts. And you knew when that happened that something very big was about to follow.
Well, let's hear from one member of the MTV generation from Spokane, Washington. Jeff's on the line. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Basically, my comment was I'm 22 years old. I've been watching The Simpsons since second grade, as you were saying earlier. And, you know, I've been watching it ever since. And I have noticed that in the past few years, a lot of my peers and a lot of the people that I do hang out with have kind of, I mean, how do I put this? They were much, I mean, they're much like me. They have a lot of the same interests, but going back to that air guitar that was mentioned earlier, it's sort of the same way because, I mean, here I am, and I'm very aware of the world situation, and I try to be as informed as possible and, you know, pay attention to environmental issues and things like that. And big
Jeff, are you trying very nicely to say that your friends aren't as smart?
Well, actually, that's what my question was. I was curious whether intelligence has to do with irony, because I feel like I'm a very ironic person, and I have a lot of dark humor. You know, I like dark humor and, you know, things like that. But it's like, I still buy CDs. I don't even have a computer to download music with. And, you know, I buy my movies at the pawn shop, and, you know, I buy old movies, and most people just say they think I was born 10 years too late.
But, can you come over to my house? I think we could have lots of fun.
Well, one of the interesting things is how you still see middle-aged to older people complaining about young people not being smart, but anybody who's around high schools these days would have to say these are the smartest kids in history when you consider the many different ways they know how to communicate and their ability to use technology and to use word processing and to publish things and to videocast, to audiocast, to do all of these things. It is astonishing what young people can today do.
And they also do it in a very fluid way, which is interesting.
I have a family that I know that the dad has to ask the six-year-old to disengage the V-chip when he wants to watch a violent movie.
All right, Jeff, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Frankfort, Kentucky next and hear from John. Hello, John. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's good to be with you. I'm 20 years old, and I'm a member of this generation that you're talking about. And I just wanted to say that I'm very optimistic about the potential for my generation, largely because of the times that we're growing up in and the things that we're seeing happen right now. And basically, just the complacency of the older generation is going to become so frustrating, I think, for my generation that we're going to have no choice but to act in a very dramatic and very forward-thinking way, like at some time in the near future, whether it's politically or societally or whatever. Just the fact that, you know, we're attacking a country right now that has done nothing to us, and a lot of my generation is very angry about it, and we don't really have any power or any say. And we see so many, you know, of our parents and of our parents' friends sitting around and just believing whatever they hear, whether it's lies or whatever. And
well, do you agree with me that your generation is going to vote more heavily than Generation X? I see a lot of signs of that.
I can only speak for myself and my friends, and I know that we will vote very heavily, but I still think that there are a lot of people in my generation that are presently so disenfranchised that they won't be quite so motivated to go out there, especially since as of this last election, you know, Gore got more of the votes and Bush is now our president, and people just say, well, then what's the point, you know? And I think eventually we're going to get so fed up that we're going to fight for a change in perhaps not even in the means of voting, but something more dramatic than that. You know,
what about that, John? Do you think you'll be doing it through media, if not through politics?
I do think that media will have a very large role to play, especially in exposing the truth, you know, and just letting the older generation know what is actually happening, because I feel that a lot of my generation has a deeper understanding of, like, the illusory nature of what we're being told and the reasons that we do things.
I see signs of a new class consciousness among young people because they've grown up at a time when there's been such a split in income and wealth, way unlike what we encountered when we were young boomers. And whereas in our time, issues of gender and race were at the fore, right now issues of class and money are coming back among today's teens.
That's interesting, though. And I wonder, Bob, if you're seeing that as well, because these are young people who have at least heard about the value of diversity since they were very little. So I would think that those messages would have permeated pretty well by now.
Well, they are. They're more savvy about all of this. They are media literate. They've taken the courses. They are much more aware of diversity and how we treat other people. And the whole the issues of race and gender have been in their educations from the beginning. And we're now beginning to see glimmers of how that may manifest itself. There's yet to be the catalyzing issue, though, I think, for the big kind of youth movement that comes every now and again in civic history. It was, of course, the draft, the war, Vietnam, back in the 1960s. We don't have an equivalent of that right now. It could be, in fact, a class conflict ultimately that does that. But strangely enough, we've yet to talk about class. How a person born in 1981 in the inner city in poverty is experiencing this new generation is so totally different from how a middle-class kid with parents who are joking about Brady Bunch are. And I think we've it's one of those other places where we've always got to be wary when we talk about generations, that we are making generalizations that that really are only broad brush strokes of understanding cultural change.
Well, Bob, let me address that, because the biggest change we're seeing among millennials is happening in the inner city among African-American kids.
I think that's true.
A very, very sharp decline in the crime rate, a sharp decline in the teen pregnancy rate, a move away from substance abuse. Inner city black kids are less likely to take almost any kind of not alcohol, cigarettes, things like that. They're way below Caucasians. The school violence rate is actually lower among majority black schools than majority white schools right now, even though it's falling for everybody. These trends are very clear among blacks, and what you see among Latinos and Asians. Of course, this is a very large Latino generation. Most of them are not immigrants themselves, though most of them are citizens. What you're seeing is cultural attitudes, family attitudes, values that come out of the Latino and Asian cultures are starting to integrate into the new millennial mindset in a way that we have not seen with prior generations. And some of this new earnestness that we're talking about actually reflects the values of those other cultures.
All right, John, we thank you so much for the call. Let's go now to Chuck, who's on the line from Fayetteville, North Carolina. Hello, Chuck.
Thank you very much. I'm the last of the boomers. I'm 39, and I have two teenagers, and you guys are right on the money. I have a daughter that is on stage doing plays all the time, and those two guys, they're optimistic and just believe in themselves and what they can do to a degree that I never was. And they are conservative to the point they make me look like Ted Kennedy. They have no faith in government's ability to do anything. But I will say this about the 9/11 thing. I think that they saw how Bush responded, and that they have confidence in their ability to use the military to go in and handle that problem. They're not afraid of terrorism the way we were of the Soviets, but I'm going to tell you, they're individualistic go-getters.
All right, Chuck, thanks so much for the call. We appreciate
Thank
the point you.
You
made. And, Bill, I do have to ask this one, because the fact that so many of these young people seem to be reluctant to go to college too far from home, that many of them actually like their parents, enjoy mm-hmm. being with them, does that
More
mean
than ever before we've seen in polls that they like their parents, they get along with adults. College counselors are reporting they're flocking in to have counseling because they bond so well with adults.
So does that mean the boomers did something right in raising them, or does this have absolutely nothing to do with us?
Well, we were raised to be the generation that would not follow a Hitler or a Stalin or an Orwellian Big Brother. And our parents wanted us to think outside the box and to question authority. We were trained to be that, and we became that in ways that they weren't necessarily expecting. Whereas today's kids, in a lot of ways, are being raised not to be criminals, not to be misbehaviors. They're raised to meet high standards. They're raised to behave. And at a certain level, that's putting stress on the kids, but it also means that they are developing new qualities of civic life that could make them very, very powerful as a force in politics and the economy and technology and science. It also is why the arts are so important, and we've got to help them retain that interest and love for music and drama and dance and the theater. But on the whole, it's a fine group of young people we have in America, and we should be very proud of them.
And, Bob, I wonder if there is any sort of dark side to this. I mean, is there a trade-off between creativity and behaving really well?
Well, I think, again, it depends on the individual. There's always a dance going on between there. The description I just heard actually sounded a little bit chilling, because it was like a retreat from that notion of thinking independently and not in lockstep. The be nice attitude, I think, is a wonderful one. The behave attitude is not necessarily always one that's good for a culture at any given time.
I agree.
I just have to say once again, though, that I think that we might be... I'm sick and tired of a lot of this irony. I would like to see it slashed by about 70%. But every time we make a prediction that it's going to go away, it doesn't happen. I hope this analysis is right, but I think this ironic beast may be a lot harder to tame than we think it is.
So if I can just get a quick yes or no on this one, are today's fourth graders tomorrow's new boomers? Are they going to be reacting to their very nice older brothers and sisters?
It's going to be the children of today's high school kids who will be the new boomers. And we have a little bit of a wait before the new Aquarius. Today's elementary school kids are mostly the children of Gen Xers, and they're being made to behave, to put it in those terms, even more than the boomers' own children were, because the Gen Xers are trying to fix what they perceive as the family problems that they themselves encountered in the 1970s and 80s.
Well, we'll have
so
to leave it there for now. All right. We'll have to watch and see what happens. Thanks so much to my guest today. Bob Thompson is director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse University. And Bill Strauss is founder of the Capital Steps and author of Millennials Rising, The Next Great Generation. Earlier in the program, we heard from Donna Learmont, a teacher at Laser High School in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection.
No such thing as the real world, just a lie, got to rise above. I just can't wait till my 10-year reunion. I'm gonna bust down the double doors, and when I stand on these tables before you, you will know what all this time.